2 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, and it's time once again for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. In the studio today with me, Ashel author Wayne Caldwell. Say hello, Wayne.
Hello, Jeff, and audience.
And audience, Radio Land. How are you doing today, Wayne?
I'm doing very well, except for the temperature outside.
Yeah, it's toasty today.
Yeah.
It is. Do you have the cicadas out in your neighborhood?
No.
No?
No, we're not plugged with those things this time.
Yeah, we do in our neighborhood. It feels like it's been forever now, but they drone all day long. It's been really interesting. I meant to record some of them and bring them in just so we could share it with those folks out there in Radio Land who are not experiencing it for themselves.
Well, you're very generous.
Well, maybe next week. Maybe next week. So, Wayne, your novel, Catalucci's been out about a year now.
Mm-hmm.
You've been out doing the authorial rounds, readings, various and sundry get-togethers. How's it going?
Well, it's going well. I have been very interested to learn several things about myself.
Have you?
This. I did not know that I had an inner extrovert, for example. I very much prefer the study and, you know, the writing part of what I do, but this part of the public end of it has been very rewarding and very, very, very much fun. I've met so many just wonderful people out there, and I'm glad to know that, contrary to the doomsaying that you read in a lot of places, people still read books.
I know.
And people still like books and buy books and that sort of thing. So that's all very refreshing.
Yes, right. For an author, that really that works.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I saw a statistic somewhere on the web last week that book sales in the United States were something above $3 billion for the year, which is, it came out to about 10 books per person.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and we know people who only read 10 books, but then there are people like us who drive the average up. And,
right.
There are those who don't read any books. But,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw something too last week, it was in conjunction with the BEA at Los Angeles meeting, that said that between self-published books and the regular mainstream published books last year, 2007, there were something like 275,000 titles
published
new in this country.
Wow.
And to have a book that is selling in the face of that is pretty cool. I like that.
Yeah. 275,000. That's a lot of books. Mm-hmm. And that's just one year.
I mean, you can be disappointed that you're not noticed in the New York Times book review or something like that.
Right.
But given that and the fact that each week they'll only do maybe 5 titles in fiction.
Right. Right. You know, obviously, the book review needs to be expanded.
Yeah.
It'd have to be 400 pages a week, though, to cover that.
It would.
Oh. Well, tell us a little bit about Catalucci. It's I've enjoyed the read. I've read it a couple times now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just browsing into it. It seems to me every time I get into it, it's richer, and I appreciate even more the level of detail you've been able to research or go into. You've done the research that enables you to really delve into what it was like living in 19th century Catalucci.
Well, thank you for that. The book basically is set in a region called Catalucci, which now is in a part of the Great Smoky Mountains National Park.
Right.
It's the easternmost part of the park in the state of North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
And for those folks who know the Catalucci area now, you go in there and you'll find 4 or 5 houses and a church and a schoolhouse, and you'll think, well, how quaint, and all of that. But when you look at the census data, I think it was the 1910 Haywood County census, tells us that there were about 1,250 people who lived in Catalucci.
Yeah.
And where did they live? Well, where did those houses go? You have to do a lot of imagining to figure out what the country looked like in 19th century and all of that sort of thing. So, yeah, I've done quite a bit of research. I hope it doesn't show as research. I hope it blends in with the story in the text.
Right, right.
But the novel opens in 1864 late when a fellow named Ezra Banks joins the Confederate Army at age 14. It continues his story. He's the main character in the book. Mm-hmm. The book ends in 1928 at his, what you might call, untimely death. Mm-hmm. And, or
maybe timely.
Maybe, maybe timely, depending on your attitude. And, so
he was a bit of a cuss.
Yes, he was. Ornery doesn't begin to describe Ezra, but anyway. The book goes into considerable detail about a couple of families that were early settlers in the Cataloochee Valley, and then Ezra came in 1880, sort of as an interloper.
Yeah,
and,
new guy.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I'm working on a second book now, which will detail what happened to these folks after the Park Service actually took over.
Yeah.
Some of them tried to stay, and some of them left, and I just want to explore the the dynamics of that. Yeah. Did I really say dynamics? I guess
you did.
I did. Sorry.
You did. What a literary word. All right. Oh, well, I noticed you didn't bring any of your second book with you today. That's...
No, I didn't. No. I perhaps should have. But.
Yeah, we'll try and get you to talk about a little bit more about it. But... Your family is from Cataloochee. Your father grew up there. Was that the case?
No, it was my grandfather.
Your grandfather.
My grandfather was born there. Yeah. My great grandfather before him was there, and my great great grandfather was one of the first settlers in the Cataloochee Valley.
So three generations in the Cataloochee Valley.
And I got interested in this, of course, by first family connections. I was not part of a family that was very close in the sense that they went to family reunions and that sort of thing.
Right.
And my father did not pass on a lot of oral tradition to me. So I came to this kind of late. I was probably 30, 35 the first time I went to Cataloochee. And I thought, wow, this would be a wonderful place to set a novel. And really didn't think much more about it, after that. That's how I first came to it, was through thinking about family. My great-grandfather was named Marion Caldwell. And he was out plowing one afternoon, and a tree fell on him and killed him. And, aside from thinking, well, that's pretty rotten luck, I got to thinking, well, how would his family have reacted to that? How did the community come together and that sort of thing? I wrote a short story about it, which won a prize, and that sort of got me to thinking, well, I've got a novel here.
Yeah, it seems like a good omen when you win a prize.
That's, it's very nice to see your name in print and to receive a check.
Right, right.
Even though I don't want to know how many cents per hour I've actually gotten with the writing of Cataloochee. Right. I don't want to know details like that.
Right, right. If it comes to a cent an hour.
Man,
right?
I seriously doubt if it would.
The writing life. So there are other little details like that that served as starting points for you. I guess the owlhead revolver that Ezra carries was another of those. The story about the man found in the creek, frozen in the creek.
Mm-hmm. That detail actually came from a cousin of my mother's who was found up South Hominy in the creek one morning, dead. And we never did, as a family, get what I thought to be an adequate explanation of that story.
That sort of demands something.
So I just sort of imagined what kind of person... I did not pattern this after my mother's cousin, whom I knew, and this guy's a totally different person, Henry Sutton. Just imagining how one, wife goes to bed, wakes up the next morning, her husband's in the creek dead. How'd this happen?
Frozen and drowned, or
or something.
Or something.
But, I tend to start on the level of sketch and work outward from details like that. I'm working on a section right now in the new book that involves a rather grim death. And there's a detail in there that I won't go into, but it'll be interesting when you get around to reading it.
Okay. All right. Something to look forward to there. So, in this book, in Cataloochee, you're basically dealing with your grandfather's era, the time when he would have been a young man, I guess, really. What were his dates?
My grandfather was born in 1880.
Yeah, right. So this would have been his life, basically.
Right.
The time of his life, yeah. So in the new book, you're going to presumably be dealing roughly with the time of your father's life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll start in it starts the morning after Cataluccia ends, as a matter of fact. And I'm not quite sure yet how many years it's going to cover. I'm sure we're going through about 1934. Now, whether we'll actually go farther than that or not, I don't know. My turn-in date's August, and we'll just see if I have time.
Wayne, that's only 60 more days.
I know. I should not be here. I should be home in the studio, but this is fun.
This is more fun.
Yeah.
I was impressed when I called you yesterday, I guess it was, and there you were writing, scribbling away. So I know you're working on this thing.
Trying my best.
So if you folks up there at Random House are listening, Wayne's got his nose to the grindstone here. Yes.
Well, I don't describe it exactly like that. I love writing. I love what I do. And what I don't like is the pressure of the deadline.
Right. You know? Right. So. Sure. That comes with having a publisher.
It does.
Right. Since they seldom seem to be content to sort of wait until you get around to submitting everything.
Well, we can keep extending the contract and revising it and that sort of thing. But after a certain point, they say, okay, here we go.
Yeah, it's time. It's time. Yeah. Well, I wonder if you'd, talk a little bit more about your background as a writer. I know you started out as a young man, you were writing poetry.
Well, yeah, I think all
Appalachian haiku.
I think all romantically inclined teenagers at least try poetry at one time or another.
Yeah,
I got to in high school. I was writing haiku, and that's just an absurd thing for an Appalachian kid to do. But I thought it was
but instructive.
It was it at least made you stay within a form. Mm-hmm. I like writing sonnets for the same reason, because you stay within a rhyme scheme and a certain amount of lines and that kind of thing.
It's nice to have a procedure.
I'm not very good at it, but I like the discipline. I did some poetry, and I'm very much hoping that any of that had been destroyed at this point. I have one poem I'm proud of. It was published in Theology Today up at Princeton University.
Huh. And when was that?
That was about 8 years ago, I think.
So before you seriously delved into the...
I was writing some short fiction that became Cataluccia at that point, but this was a poem about Samson, and I'm not quite sure where that one came from, but it did. I have written also some book reviews and a few things like that over the years. Mm-hmm. I wrote a history of Hominy Baptist Church back in the mid-'80s.
Oh, yeah.
Out in Candler, and was a member of that church then. And I expect there are some copies of that still out there.
I've seen a few around.
That sort of thing really got me to thinking that I could do a long-term project, like a novel. It was not really until I turned 50, which is 10 years ago, that I started thinking, well, if you're ever going to write, you better get started.
Might not be a bad idea.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, you could wait till you were 60, but then again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So how did you get from that early, these early Appalachian haikus to a full-fledged novel? I mean, you're... degree, you went to college, your degree is, you actually have degrees in English and theology, is that correct?
I have 3 degrees in English literature.
3 degrees in English literature, but a strong interest in theology and religion.
My dissertation subject was George Herbert, who is the premier English devotional poet.
Indeed.
And
and a great poet.
And to boot.
Yeah, to boot.
Right. Dunn, Herbert, Milton were my great loves in graduate school. And I've continued to read that sort of thing and even keep up with some of the literary criticism. But that's probably neither here nor there. But the writing of short stories, really, is where I started the Catalucci project. And after, I'd say, four or five short stories, well, I had four short stories published. And by the third one, I was actually working on a novel. So I could see then that I had enough, what do they call it, critical mass to go on with such a thing. And that was pretty cool.
Indeed, indeed. So that was four stories, you said? Over a period of how long was that?
That's over a period of about 2.5-3 years.
2.5 or 3 years.
Something like that.
Yeah. But that told you you had the stuff, you had the critical mass of material to work with.
I had enough material to pull off a long-term project, and also told me that I had a little bit of talent, which is kind of nice to hear.
Always.
I didn't think, for example, that I could write dialogue. My first short story had absolutely no dialogue in it. And after I started writing it, I found I had an ear for these people and how they said things. So that worked out well, too.
It worked out well. Mm-hmm. Indeed. Well, you're listening to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, today in the studio with me, author Wayne Caldwell, who is working on his second novel. He's just had his first novel out for about a year now.
About a year.
Mm-hmm. That's Catalucci. Well, Wayne, let's hear a little bit of Catalucci. Would you read some for us?
I'd be glad to. You want a big section or a little section?
Well, let's start with a fairly big one.
Let me start with a little one, actually.
Okay, start with a big little one then.
This will explain a couple of things. I think I mentioned that Ezra Banks came into Catalucci about 1880.
Right.
He was an old man of 30 at that point, a bachelor, and he was looking for a bride and some land.
Yeah.
And found both. He found the bride in the person of a girl named Hannah Carter, who was half his age. She was 15.
Yeah.
And this is a scene from very early in their married life.
Well, good. Great.
While Ezra was out, Hannah had visited her mother. They talked of weather and church. And Hannah at last mentioned that lately she had felt strange. Kate listened to Hannah's symptoms, then put her hand on her daughter's forehead. Mama, do you think I'm sick? Child, you might be in a family way. Hannah stood at the mantel and turned sideways like a squirrel, staring at her mother. She dropped into the rocker. Are you sure? Hannah said, her voice halfway between fright and excitement. Law, child, the only thing I'm sure about is crows is black and Jesus loves us. But from what you say, it's likely. Hannah picked at her apron hem and bit her lower lip. She looked at her mother, hesitation all over her face. Now, sweetheart, you'll be fine, said Kate. Carter women is good at birthing babies. You're a little young, but you're strong. You got to eat good. I got some fresh turnip greens that'll put some iron in your blood. She walked over and put her hand on Hannah's shoulder. My baby. Having a baby of her own. I'll just pause here and say that my first editor underlined turnip greens in the typescript and sent it back to me with a question mark in the margin. It just said, green turnips? She had no understanding of what a bag of turnip greens might be, but...
She was not from around here.
She was not from around here. I mailed perhaps the only can of turnip greens that's ever gone to Park Avenue in New York to her.
Well, good. Good.
There's a lot of ignorance out there.
There is.
To continue this story, though.
Please do.
Before Hannah started the rest of their supper, she went to the front porch for a breath of air. The sun was behind the house, so she went back inside for a shawl. Promise of a cool night. Outside, she looked to the ridgetop, still washed in light. It reminded her of the way light came into church sometimes, brushing the pulpit with gold. Lord, she said softly, if you give me a boy, I'll do my best to make him a preacher. Sitting on the stoop, she couldn't think of a preacher at all in her family, and surely not one in Ezra's. A man of God out in the world. Maybe he could preach at our church when he comes home, she thought. She would name him Samuel, after Hannah's son in the Bible, and William, after her father, Samuel William Banks. She watched the sunset behind the ridgetop. A little later, Ezra comes into the kitchen. Hannah says, "Ezra, I got something to tell you." "What's that?" "Mama thinks I'm in a family way." His eyes brightened like pennies. "You really mean that?" She nodded. "Hannah, that's mighty fine news. I hope it's a boy. For a fact, I do. Zebulon Baird Banks. How's that for a name? I've been turning it over in my mind ever since the war." He hugged her and turned her around in a little dance. She bit her lower lip. "Don't you like the sound of it? You remember our governor during the war? Zeb Vance is the only one a soldier could name a son after. He kept us North Carolina soldiers in food when Tennessee's didn't have none. I couldn't hardly name a first son nothing else. I'd thought to name him Samuel William." He let her go and sat at the table like he was mustering troops in his head for a fight. "You don't know my old man's name. Samuel. I wouldn't name a damn goat after him. And the William's after your daddy, I bet. Now, he's a good man, but he's too fond of his liquor. In fact, he's about as bad a drunk as my old man was, except he don't get mean with it. No, my boy will be named for a great man. That's all there is to it." Ezra went to the front porch to look at the mountaintop and scratch himself proudly. Hannah stirred up cornbread and hoped her firstborn would be a girl.
I'll tell you a story of little Lomi Wise, how she became deluded by John Lewis's lies. He told her to meet him down by Adam's Spring, some money he would bring and some other fine thing. Then fool like she met him at Adam's Spring, no money he brought her nor other fine thing. No money, no money to flatter the case. We'll go and get married, there'll be no disgrace. John Lewis.
Little Omi Wise there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, in the studio today with author Wayne Caldwell. Well, that was a mighty fine selection there. I always enjoyed that. I remember that from my reading of the book. It struck me at the time as being absolutely dead on in lots of ways.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Captured the whole sexual dynamic, to use that dynamic word again,
mm-hmm.
that would have prevailed, I think, in those days and times within a marriage. My grandmother as well was married to a man who was twice her age,
mm-hmm.
which was pretty much a normal thing at the time. I mean, that was...
It was certainly not unheard of.
Not unheard of at all. Yeah. So let's hear a little bit more Cataluci here.
Okay. Well, the selection you just played reminded me of some of the mountain traditions, of course, ballad things,
yeah,
and legends and folk tales and one thing or another.
Yeah.
I want to read a little story here that is proof that the oral tradition is still alive in
mm-hmm.
these mountains.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just preface it by saying that my late neighbor, had a bird dog.
Mm-hmm.
And that bird dog would come visit me sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know where I live, you know that's not a very bright thing for a bird dog to do, because mm-hmm. they get run over and
right.
all like that.
Lots of traffic out
yeah.
that way.
So I got home, and here's the bird dog. So I called Roy and said, "Come get your dog." And he did. And he got out of his truck. And he said, "Wayne, I want to tell you a story." And he told me this story. I could mm-hmm. not wait for him to leave so I could get inside and write it down. And Roy was a teller of tall tales, but this is just about how this one went. In Cataluci, it gets transformed into a story by Bud Harrigan, who comes to work for Silas Wright, one of the farmers in the valley there. Harrogate's kind of an outsider, and he's kind of a weird guy, but he tells this story at the dinner table. Silas's wife, Retta, wants to make him, if not sing for his supper, at least tell a story. Mm-hmm. So here he goes. I was in the fourth grade. There was some boys ahead of me, you know, seventh graders. Some of them was shaving, they'd be kept back so much. I was scared of them, mostly Billy Turner. Billy, he'd up in the morning ask the teacher if he could go out, you know, to the outhouse. He'd go and come back and by another and do the same. They was going out to the creek where we kept our dinner buckets and eating the young'uns' dinners. We was too scared to tell on them, so they had a good business going. One day I told my old man I didn't get no dinner. Well, he knowed the teacher, Mr. Burris. He was a red-headed man with freckles all over his face. So Pap went over to his place and said somebody'd smouched my dinner. Next morning, Mr. Burris sat on the edge of his desk and stared at us for a minute or two, tapping his britches leg with a ruler. Seemed like forever. Then he started telling us a story. Said when he was a pup, he done time in the penitentiary for stealing. Well, I looked at Billy Turner, and his face screwed up proper. Then Mr. Burris told it, kind of like this. First thing was, when I was 10, I started stealing lunches from the young'uns at school. I'd go out and get me a sweet tater and come back. Then I'd get bold and clean out the whole bucket, ham, beans, taters, and all. Got away with it, too. Pretty soon, that wasn't enough. I'd steal crackers at the store, or snuff, or a thimble, any old thing laying around. Then it got to be shotgun shells or a pack of cigarettes. And then I thought, well, sir, stealing is pretty good. I'd done left school by then. So you know what? My place was pretty ratty, so I figured I'd fix things up. I come upon a farm that was handy, and that night I got the hay out of the barn. Took it home and hid it. Next night I come back for the barn. Put the hay back in it. Made several trips, but I got the house and the corn crib and the smokehouse and the outhouse and put them over at my place. I got the corn shocks and the pitchforks and the bee gums and every heifer, sheep, and chicken. Most trouble was the hogs. The last night I got the well. But dug it up and put it on my shoulders, and you know what? I was carrying it home when the high sheriff shined his light in my face and said, "Boy, it's all over for you." I did years of hard labor for that, and it won't a bit of fun. But you know what I learned in them years? I learned there ain't nothing worth stealing. Not a cracker, not a farm, not a man's land, nothing. And then Mr. Burris, he sorted us into grades and started teaching. And not a one of us got our dinner stole after that.
Yeah.
And Roy told that for the truth.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And, yeah, I appreciate a tall tale just as much as anybody. But that just floored me that in 2003 or four, whenever that was, that this was, he just, you know, swapped that tail with me, and all I gave him was his bird dog back.
He was glad to have the dog, I guess.
Yeah.
That's a good story. Yeah. Well, so who are your models as an author? You read all the time, and I know I've known you for what, 20 years or 30 years now, and I know you as one of the most literate and, you know, learned characters around town. And so who do you read? I know you read Faulkner.
I read Faulkner religiously.
Yeah.
If 5 or 6 months goes by and I haven't reread something of his, I think there's...
You've fallen down.
Kind of, it's kind of like a vitamin deficiency.
Yeah.
I've got to do something about that.
Yeah.
Of living authors, I read Cormac McCarthy. I think he's probably one of our best living stylists.
Amazing guy.
Writer. I very much like and admire Charles Fraser's work. I like Annie Proulx. She just had a short story in the New Yorker 2 or 3 weeks ago that just knocked me off my feet. What's it called? The Them Old Cowboy Songs, I believe it is.
Them Old Cowboy Songs. So, I'll look that one up.
It's really great. I don't know. There's just a lot of people that have influenced my work. Thinking of Flannery O'Connor for one, the way she works with color, that kind of thing. It runs male, female, all over the place. You know.
Yeah. Well.
Even
imagination doesn't care.
That's right. And I find myself, the older I get, the more drawn I am to the Old Testament narratives. Mm-hmm. Things like the binding of Isaac, which is just such a strange story. Mm-hmm. And so starkly told that it's almost, you know, it's so artfully done that it's not artful, if you understand that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I come back to a lot of that kind of thing as well. Mm-hmm. And then there are things that I'm just now getting around to reading. I just last week finished Vanity Fair for the first time, for example.
Yeah. Oh, Becky Sharp.
Just a damn delightful book.
Isn't it amazing?
It's been on my shelf for 40 years.
Yeah.
I just never have gotten around to it. The retail mm-hmm. price on my copy of Vanity Fair was $2.45.
Yeah, it'd be hard to find for that anymore. And well worth it.
Yes.
Oh.
So I'm still broadening my horizons, if you will.
Yeah. That is an amazing book. And Vanity Fair has stuck with me, too, over the years. Yeah. Really a classic, for sure. Yeah. Huh. So one of the things that struck me about Cataluzzi on my third trip through was the story of Henry Sutton.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this. What is the name of the chapter now? That's of where Henry comes to a sort of. It's not the fox caught in the lantern light. No,
it's no more power.
Yeah, and it begins with what's really an interior monologue. On Henry's part, and it struck me how difficult that must be to create in a historical novel, because first you have to get what would be going through his mind. I mean, just the contents of consciousness of another era, and then you have to make it into convincing interior monologue.
Right.
And then in this chapter, something amazing happens, because this man who's been the whole point of view for the last, five pages or so, suddenly vanishes from the narrative, and it's really an interesting transition, just a really, really neat shift. Could you perhaps go into that one a little bit?
I would be glad to. Just prefacing that by saying that Henry Sutton is one of my favorite characters in the book.
Mm-hmm. He is.
Because he tends to think like I do, which is to say, not linearly at all.
Right.
My first editor, the turnip greens person, wanted me to get rid of...
The green turnips. Yes.
She wanted me to get rid of Henry. She didn't think Henry was an intrinsic enough part of the story, and I had to stand my ground on that one.
Yeah.
But I like Henry. He's not very bright, but he is...
Has some bad habits.
He has some bad habits, but don't we all?
Yeah.
And he's just he's an interesting guy. He is introduced in the story, by the way, with, as you say, an interior monologue. I show him in conversation with his mule's backside.
Mm-hmm.
He's plowing, and he's trying not to go to sleep.
Right.
That's what he's doing.
Right.
So he's meditating and talking out loud to his mule. And,
or the posterior section of his mule.
Exactly. It's not quite as good as Feral Sam's' little story about mule farts, but it's close. But then Feral's been doing this a lot longer than I have.
Got a head start on you there.
Yeah. And... I should live as long as Feral Sam's do.
Yeah.
But the story No More Power also talks about sort of Henry's interior life a little bit. Mm-hmm. I'll read a section of that.
Please do. Mm-hmm.
See what we can do. The situation as the chapter begins is that a new thing we learn about Henry is that he raised fighting gamecocks.
Right.
And if you've ever been around those birds, they're nasty and they're mean-tempered and they make a lot of racket. And
His neighbors
didn't like it at all.
Yeah.
So he is having to kill his last two roosters. He's going to stew them for, I don't know how long it takes to get a fighting cock tender, a week or two,
maybe. Or two, yeah, right. This was before we had food processors and blenders.
Exactly.
You could puree it today.
So, let's see. Now in 1917, he was down to two roosters, and Callie, his wife, was convinced that the devil had gotten into both of them. That's the other part of the situation here. Callie is a victim of what the 17th century would have called religious melancholy. Mm-hmm. She's nuts, as a matter of fact, and she thinks the devil's behind every green tree.
Right.
But anyway, that's what's going on there.
Yeah.
He figured the roosters would need to stew for 2 days to get them tender enough to eat, and I may have underestimated that. First thing was to whet the axe head, for tough and mean as these birds were bound to be, he didn't want to have to chop at their necks more than once. His mother always wrung chickens' heads off, but as far as he knew, she'd never killed a fighting cock. He'd bolted an old mower seat to the grindstone frame and turned the wheel with a bicycle crank and chain, so when he sharpened his tools, he looked like he was riding slowly to nowhere, showering the way with sparks. Here we go now. Wonder how things got this way. Callie seeing the devil behind evergreen tree. I think she'd be all right if Tom hadn't died like he did. Bless him, he was a fine boy. Only 17 when that boar's tush ripped his leg and he got blood poisoning. His mama's only boy, and a favorite one if he'd had brothers. Lord, when was that? May 1913 he died, the 24th. I mind it was a pretty Saturday when I found him dead in Callie's arms. She was sitting on the bed telling him he'd be all right. I took that rag she'd been wiping his forehead with and cried my own tears on it and dabbed it on him, but it didn't do no good. My fine boy, dead. Like to have killed me, but I made out. That's what you do. You put one foot in front of the other and go on. But she started talking about seeing the devil everywhere after that. He turned the axe head and honed the other side. That's getting more like it. It's about sharp enough. Got to grind that nick out of the edge. Looks like a cut of fence wire with it. Oh, Callie had been talking about the devil since that curly woman killed her 2-year-old grandyoungin. That was 1913, too. The old woman told folks she was taking the girl to the county home because she couldn't afford to keep her, but instead climbed clear up Ad Tate Knob and stuck her in a hole and covered it up with rocks. I don't know if she knocked the girl's head in or if she just covered her up and left her screaming. Somebody noticed they never showed up at the county home, so we got to hunting for her. Must have been 500 men and boys. Found her after a couple of weeks. Bad business. To think a body could do that to her own flesh and blood made a man think about the devil, sure enough. Made Callie talk about it. And Preacher Will Smith preached about a snake slipping into our Eden here in Haywood. And that must have made a big dent in Callie's mind, because that evening she read me about Jesus making them demons jump into all them hogs. Who I felt sorry was the farmers. Did Jesus pay them for their livestock? Anyway, this goes on. You get the idea.
Was that the story about the grandmother who buries her 2-year-old grandchild under rocks? Was that an historical?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. I know some people who remembered that.
Yeah.
And I got a hold of a little book at a used bookstore some years ago called A Serpent Slips Into a Modern Eden.
Ooh.
And it was the story of this lady who's, yeah. I say lady, this woman who's, I think her actual name was Nance Dude.
Uh-huh.
And she's had some retelling of that particular story later, but, or lately,
yeah.
I should say.
Mm. Yeah.
But yeah, that would have been in the Haywood County consciousness in 1913.
Right.
But you mentioned Henry's bad habits. One is that he's a little bit bad to drink.
A bit.
And he likes to have a little nip before he goes to bed.
Yeah.
The problem is Callie's a Methodist and won't let him keep liquor in the house. So he's got to keep it in the barn. The other part of Callie's problem is that she likes her patent medicine, but
right.
You know, that's the ironic.
Which also is about 40% alcohol.
Exactly. So anyway, one night Callie went upstairs early, about 7, and he walked to the barn for a deep draft a bit thereafter. It was clear, a bit windy, and the ground crunched underfoot with ice. Going to the barn, normal rhythm, 42 steps to the footbridge. Back in the house, the beadboard ceiling creaked. He found her upstairs in her rocker, tears falling in her lap, muttering about the devil and Jesus mixed together. He persuaded her to get to bed, then went downstairs to sit by the fireplace with no hint of coming sleep. The wind picked up and the west end of the house popped. His legs tensed and chest tightened like when he ran out of tobacco. He walked around the room, pausing at Callie's picture on the mantel. She ain't smiled like that in years. Sighing, he laid a piece of locust on the fire and listened to it crackle. He figured another dram wouldn't hurt. Putting on his coat, he went to the porch, taking care not to bang the screen door. The dipper had rotated a bit since his last trip. He crunched the 42 steps, haltingly crossed the creek, and leaned into the shelter of the barn. Even in cold weather, the barn smelled of comfort. Little Sal, the new mule, moved in her stall, and Petunia the cow lowed at him. "Hello again. I know this is twice, but I ain't crazy. I just need some sleep." The cold fluid went down his throat, and a rivulet spilled down the corner of his mouth. He sat in the shelter of the hay, cradled in the warmth of the whiskey. He didn't know how long he had been there when he started awake. Clear-headed, but unsteady as to legs, he capped the nearly empty jar, reached the barn entrance, and leaned against the doorpost with deep, painful breaths. He had never seen stars so bright. Halfway across the bridge, his right foot sailed out from under him. He yelled, "Jesus!" as his body lurched to the right. When he hit the poplar railing, it snapped, and he flipped and fell. It seemed forever before his head hit a rock in the creek. His body settled like a sack of cotton batting. In the frigid water, scattered thoughts buzzed toward the back of his brain. "Orion's near about behind the mountain, so spring ain't far off. Feels warmer. That red light's Callie, coming to help. The devil, too. And looky, here comes Jesus."
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, then the next day.
The next morning, Callie gets to looking for him and finds him face up in the creek, staring at her.
Yeah.
And that is a redemptive thing, really, because it gets Callie to quit that patent medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she gives up her Lydia Pinkhams. And
yep.
Yep, you're right, right. Cleans out the house. He'd actually been making her Lydia Pinkhams for her.
Yes.
After he realized that it was nothing but alcohol and a bunch of herbs.
Right.
He figured he could come up with his own. Yeah. So, yeah. Well, that's a fine turn in the book, I think. I'm surprised your editor wanted to take that out. I mean, the story, you know, it seems, this, of course, Ezra is the focus in lots of ways of the book, but it's really about a community. There are lots of people in it, more than in most novels.
I learned a term after I got hooked up with Random House that I had never, well, I may have known it, but I didn't pay it any attention, called overarching plot.
Overarching plot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and I don't have overarching plot.
Oh no!
Really, the reviewers. Some of the reviewers have called this a meandering tale.
Mm. They needed that overarching plot.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think meandering is code for Southern. But I don't mind.
Yeah,
that's the kind of like I say. I think like Henry Sutton thinks, and communities evolve. Like that, and there, it doesn't go from point A to point B in a single arc.
Right.
It just doesn't do it.
Right.
And she thought that, I'm sure that she thought Henry Sutton was kind of a side thing in the plot.
Not essential to the narrative.
Exactly.
Yes. Right.
And for God's sake, I had a dead mule kind of tied up with Henry there.
Yep.
Yeah, I made mention of Little Sal, the new mule.
Mm-hmm.
Well, old Sal got killed, and... in an attempt to make sure that this is considered a Southern novel, I had to put a dead mule in it.
Well, of course. So, right, know. Right. Every Southern novel needs a dead mule at some point.
Well, that's the thesis of Jake Mills, who was my Renaissance professor at Carolina.
Uh-huh.
He wrote an article back in the 90s sometime, and the title will tell you how tongue-in-cheek this article is. Uh-huh. It's called Equine Gothic, : The dead mule is signifier in Southern fiction.
Ooh, I like it. Critical theory on, right. brought to bear.
he was simply saying that people have written a lot of claptrap about Southern fiction, you know, about how it's glued together by family or religion mm-hmm. or land or that mm-hmm. sort of thing. He said, no. What makes it Southern is, does it have a dead mule in it? And there's now a dead mule club, a bar in Chapel Hill, that will attest to the ubiquity of these things.
I'm going to have to go back and re-examine the whole Southern canon now
there you go.
In light of the dead mule.
Cormac McCarthy, by the way, is the king of dead mules. He mm-hmm. has several hundred dead mules in his works.
He has dead mules, dead horses, right. dead, you name it.
Yep.
If it's got legs, it's died in Cormac McCarthy's books.
Yep.
Oh. It's Wordplay on WPVM 103.5 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. With me today in the studio, author Wayne Caldwell. Well, Wayne, do share another section of Cataluchi with us, if you would.
Okay, I'd be glad to. This is very early on in the book, and it tells a family story that I've just sort of changed the names on to protect the innocent, as you might say. Like most of his kin, Hiram Carter liked to dwell on family history. If he didn't know a detail, he'd make it up. Countless times he told how the Carters came to Cataluchi. The telling varied somewhat, but always began with his grandfather, called Old Jimmy Carter, because in his 30s his hair turned solid white. 2 years before President Jackson ran the Cherokees off to Oklahoma, in 1836, Old Jimmy and his sons, Levi, Hiram's father, and Levi's brothers, William, Lafayette, whom they called Uncle Fate, and Andy, stood at Cove Creek Gap, peering into Cataluchi, like Moses looking at the Promised Land, except they got to go in. They had come from Spring Creek, then in Buncombe County, which Old Jimmy said was getting too populous for him. It's getting so people live right on top of you, he'd say. It ain't natural. So he bought 100 acres from Colonel Love, the land speculator, in a region the Cherokees called Gadaluzzi, which meant something like standing in rows. By the time Love got through with the name, all any white person knew to call it was Cataluchi, and in another generation most had shortened that to Cataluch. When the Carters spied out the land, they found nobody there, so they cleared the footpath. Love had the brass to call a turnpike, enough to drag a mule-drawn sled without it skittering off the mountainside. They went back to Buncombe, loaded up their families, piled sleds high with cook pots and chicken coops, tethered milk cows behind, and journeyed 4 days to Jonathan's Creek. Then they held on for dear life up 7 miles of Corkscrew Road from Cove Creek, and then the same from the gap down into Big Cataluchi. It was mostly wilderness then. Trout the size of handsaws, poplars big as silos, poison oak vines thick as a man's leg. They built a cabin by the creek, and at night the big cats they call painters screamed at them, some nights from the roof peak, sounding for the world, like women being beaten. Old Jimmy hurt his back badly and moved back to Buncombe after the first winter. But Hiram's father, Levi, took root, and he and his wife, Lib, made a good farm. Next year, a family of Howells settled down the creek from them, and they all built a Methodist church. Hiram's Uncle Will, much like his father, said, "Brothers, I'm going over the mountain where it ain't this crowded." He settled in Little Cataloochee among a nest of Davises, all Baptists. They were not hard shells, so Will joined them. "The only difference in Methodists and Baptists is water, and I don't reckon that's worth fighting about," he said. Hiram was 14 the spring of 1865. Levi and Lib, and Hiram's four younger brothers, didn't have much to eat that year besides turnips and honey and fish and what game they could shoot, and had run slap out of salt. Lib dug dirt out back where she had tossed dishwater for years and boiled it down in an iron kettle over and over till something crusted in the pot a man could call salt if he didn't look at it too closely nor taste it too tightly. When Colonel George Kirk scattered Ezra's company and came through Cataloochee, Hiram and Levi hightailed it toward the mountain, but the Yankees ran them down, marched them to old man Bennett's place, and tied them up in the barn. The soldiers found Bennett's whiskey. Hiram worked himself loose and untied his father and Bennett while the Yankees drank and shouted and knocked over a coal oil lantern. Hiram stuck his nose out of the barn to see the house crackling and roaring. Hiram and Levi dove into the ivy while old man Bennett stood in his yard and cursed what he called the heathen bastards. Kirk's men beat Bennett and caught Levi when he tripped over a root, but Hiram hid until the company moved on. Lib and Hiram heard no word from Levi until the next October. Hiram was helping pickle kraut when a hoot chorused from the edge of the woods. Hiram wondered what an owl was doing out at 10 in the morning, then remembered Levi's hunting signal. Levi sidled out of the woods. He was so thin, Lib nearly killed him with her hugs. They had no fatted calf, but Hiram shot a couple of squirrels. Levi had always said he would raise out of his coffin for Lib's squirrel stew, but he only sipped at a spoonful. He had spent nearly a year on the run, sleeping in barns if he were lucky, stealing from people's gardens, hiding from a war he didn't know was over. Once home, he stayed in bed and died before the first snow. After that, Lib kept up the motions of life until the last child was out of school, then looked at Hiram and said, "I'm through working, son." Hiram laughed, but she meant it. That was the spring of 1879. She was 62 and would live to be nearly 100. The rest of her days she wouldn't hardly strike a lick at a snake. She sat on the porch or in the chimney corner and dipped snuff. Except for a rare fit of loquacity, she was silent. Hiram allowed she was saving up talk for Levi, and when she got to heaven, she'd give him an earful for dying on her, like he did.
Remarkable book, Wayne.
Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah. Now, folks who might be interested can get more information about the book and about your work in general at your website, I understand, these days.
That's www.waynecaldwell.com.
WayneCaldwell.com.
You can buy the book off the website. You can get a preview of the next book. Mm-hmm. There's a printed interview. Lots of pictures of Cataloochee, one thing or another. Mm-hmm. Some pretty good music. So yeah, that's one thing. The other thing I'd probably emphasize is that this coming Tuesday, June 10th, mm-hmm. is the paperback publication.
Oh really?
I'll be at McIntyre's Bookstore in Pittsburgh that evening, previewing that.
Well, good to know. This is very timely.
And I'll be at I'll be reading at Malaprop's June 21st, Saturday.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that myself. So. Yeah, well, do check out WayneCaldwell.com, and if you want production notes on today's show, you can go to naturespoetry.blogspot.com, where I'll have notes about the music and some more notes about the show in general. So do check that out.
Mighty hard road that my poor hand is hold. My poor feet has traveled a hot, dusty road. out of your dust bowl, and westward we rolled, and your desert was hot, and your mountains was cold. In your orchards of peaches and prunes, slept on the ground in the light of your moon. On the edge of your city you've seen us, and then we come with the dust and we go with the wind. California and Arizona, I make all your crops, and it's north up to Oregon to gather your hops. Dig the beets from your ground, cut the grapes from your vine, to set on your table your light sparkling wine. Green pastures of plenty from dry desert ground, from that grand coulee dam where the water runs down. Ever stayed in this union, us migrants have been. We'll work in this fight, and we'll fight till we win. Well, it's always we ramble, that river and I, all along your green valley I'll work till I die. My land I'll defend with my life if it be, 'cause my pastures of plenty must always be free.